to have the opportunity for public comment tonight. So please, if you intend to make a comment, please fill out this card and hand it to one of the PG&E folks here in the blue shirts. And you can also fill out this card and write something on the back. You don't have to speak, but they will be reviewed by the panel. Before we begin the meeting, we would like to start with a safety moment. So I'll turn that over to Adam Passman.
Thank you, Chuck. So, yeah, covering safety. This evening, we have our Diablo Canyon Fire Department here. They're back in the rear of the room in uniform, and should we need their assistance to begin to administer first aid or CPR, they will do so. My colleague, Brandy Lopez, will call 911 in the event of an emergency and meet emergency services. And if we experience an earthquake this evening, let's just duck and cover as best we can, and let's wait for the shaking to subside and evacuate the building. And evacuation, if you just go into the lobby here, to the left will be Monterey, and to the right is Higuera, so we'll assemble out there. And with that, I'll turn it back to you, Chuck. Thank you.
My name's Lauren Brown, and I live in San Luis Obispo.
Hi, everyone. I'm Kara Woodruff, and I'm also from San Luis Obispo.
I'm Frank Meacham. I live in Paso Robles.
Dina Bellman, rural Rio Grande.
David Baldwin, Atascadero.
Sherry Danoff, Avila area.
Linda Seeley, Los Osos.
Nancy O'Malley, Avila Beach.
John Frank, and I'm with PG&E, and I live in Pismo Beach.
Alex Carlin, I live in San Luis Obispo.
And John, would you like to welcome on behalf of PG&E?
Absolutely. Welcome to both the panel members and members of the community. I just want to thank the panel. For those of you in the community, you've got a tireless group up here representing you, and I want to thank them for their time. You see them a few hours right now by our current schedule a month in the public meetings, but behind the scenes, they really are very engaged with information we're providing them, asking questions. The effort is not a small one, and I want to thank the panel again for their engagement. It's very important to us as the community and the stewards of the facility and the lands to get the input that we're receiving. I'll give a quick update on a few things. One, we did receive word today that in the State Assembly, State Bill 1090 passed out of subcommittee to the overall Assembly. This is the bill that is addressing community impact, among other things, following the eventual shutdown and decommissionings to help mitigate community impact. So we're continuing to track progress of that state bill, and I know that the community is following that closely because there's ties to support for the community in that state bill. Tonight is going to be a lot about the processes that we'll be going through, specifically the processes that help provide the funds required for the eventual decommissioning activities for the Diablo Canyon site. As we've indicated in a previous meeting, we're looking for over $3 billion worth of funding, most of which is already in a trust fund, but we're moving towards a very clear cost estimate for the remaining work, and we wanted to inform the community of that process. Today's and tonight is an opportunity to learn more about that. And with that, again, thank the panel for their involvement, and we welcome the community comment at the end when the presentation is done and your questions. Our goal is to continue to be twofold. One, continue to operate the plant safely, reliably through the end of its current operating license, the most important aspect of our job, and then following that to prepare for successful and efficient and effective decommissioning process for the facility after shutdown, having engaged the community in a very transparent and open process. We continue to work through that with this panel tonight. So thank you.
Thank you, John. I want to go over the agenda very quickly. You all, there are copies of the agenda back on the table. And again, this is discussing the triennial proceeding, or nuclear decommissioning triennial cost proceeding. And, and we're talking about the process of how that works.
So today's agenda is going to focus on the regulatory process, the planning that's required, approvals for future state, and project execution. And we'll be hearing from experts on each one of those topics. The panel will have the opportunity to ask questions of the presenters between each of the presentations. And then we're going to take a break. And so anyone that wishes to speak, again, fill out a blue card and submit it by the break, which will be 8:30. So please get those in. And if you don't get your card in by that time, we're unfortunately not going to have the opportunity to speak. Then we're going to have public comment session, and the panel can ask some questions. And then we'll discuss the next meeting topic and do a review of our meeting. So that's tonight's agenda. So with that, I just want to note that this meeting is being live streamed, and the meeting will also be available to review by video after the meeting. So if you go on to the decommissioning panel website, you'll see a link to see the live streaming and also a link to the previous meetings. Let's talk about our presenters. That we're going to talk about the process. And Dina Toy is our first presenter. She's going to talk about regulatory process. And Eric Nelson will talk about the planning process. Tom Jones, the approvals that are necessary. And Lauren Sharp about actually project execution. So I would like to introduce Deanna. Deanna Toy is a PG&E Director of Regulatory Affairs. Her team is responsible for the development and management of PG&E electric and regulatory filings at the California Public Utilities Commission, and that includes nuclear decommissioning. She has over 20 years of utility experience and is a proud graduate of Cal Poly. So with that, I'll turn it over to Deanna.
Great. Thank you, Chuck. And good evening, everyone. So I am going to walk you through the regulatory process that California has set up to ensure that there's adequate funding for nuclear decommissioning. So first, who has the authority over ensuring that there's sufficient funding for nuclear decommissioning in California? And that is the California Public Utilities Commission, or the Commission, as I may refer to them. They're a state agency that was established in 1945, and they regulate privately owned utilities in California. That includes electric, gas, water, and telecommunications utilities. Specifically, they regulate and review nuclear decommissioning costs and projects. And that jurisdiction was granted to them under the California Nuclear Facility Decommissioning Act. Now, decommissioning is defined as removing nuclear facilities safely from service and reducing residual radioactivity to a level that permits release of the property for unrestricted use. So the 1985 Act was passed by state legislation to ensure that there's sufficient funding available to decommission nuclear facilities upon shutdown. As early as 1983, the CPUC has ordered PG&E to begin forecasting its nuclear decommissioning costs to, one, make sure that there's adequate funding, and two, to make sure the decommissioning costs would be distributed equitably over time among all customers who benefit from the operation of Diablo Canyon. So what does the commission do to confirm that there's adequate funding for decommissioning? Under the 1985 Act, the commission established the Nuclear Decommissioning Cost Triennial Proceeding, or the NDCTP, as a proceeding to examine nuclear decommissioning costs, funding levels for the trust fund that each utility establishes to fund decommissioning, and then the assumptions associated with that funding level. Specifically, the NDCTP application that the commission will approve that PG&E puts forward is to collect sufficient revenues in customer electric rates to cover reasonable and prudent decommissioning costs. So PG&E files its NDCTP application every 3 years. And in that application, we propose an annual revenue requirement to cover nuclear decommissioning costs over a 3-year period. And the approved revenue requirement is the amount that PG&E is authorized to collect from its customers. Now, the revenue requirement can and will be adjusted every 3 years with subsequent NDCTP applications as new information becomes available. We filed our last application in March of 2016, and our intent is to file our next application in March of 2019. So what is in the NDCTP? What does PG&E do to ensure that there's adequate funding for decommissioning? The application includes a decommissioning cost estimate and assumptions around how that cost estimate is developed, a review of any decommissioning projects that were completed since the last application was filed, and also any assumptions around the trust fund, the rate of return, and funding requirements. So specifically, the revenue requirement that PG&E requests in its NDCTP application is based on the beginning balance of the trust fund, any market growth assumptions for the trust fund, including the rate of return projections, the updated decommissioning cost estimate for Diablo Canyon, and then actual costs of any decommissioning projects that have been completed. So for the upcoming NDCTP application that we will be filing in March of 2019, we will be including a site-specific decommissioning cost estimate for Diablo Canyon, and you'll hear more from Eric Nelson about that. That will also include an assessment for expediting dry cask loading. We will also be including the estimate of costs for completing a public stakeholder process prior to disposition of Diablo Canyon's facilities and surrounding lands. And we will also be including an estimate of cost of emergency planning activities, including maintenance of the public warning sirens and funding of community and statewide planning functions until termination of the license. So how long does the process take? When we filed our 2015 application, it took approximately 14 months. We filed in March. We got a decision in May of the following year. There are several steps to the process. In month one, this is where interested parties who have been granted party status by the commission will file comments on our application. A pre-hearing conference is scheduled by the assigned administrative law judge, and in that pre-hearing conference, the applicant, PG&E, and the interested parties will comment on the scope and the schedule for the proceeding. A scoping memo is issued, which will then outline the schedule and the scope for the proceeding. In our 2015 application, a technical workshop was required by the commission, and it was held up at Humboldt to review decommissioning work that had been completed there. For our 2015 application, and we also expect in our 2019 application, evidentiary hearings are held, and this is where witnesses who have sponsored testimony in the application will be submitted to cross-examination by interested parties. And following that, opening and reply briefs are filed by the applicant and interested parties, summarizing the benefits of their proposal and rebutting the key components of intervener or opposing proposals. For our 2015 application, it was roughly 6 months after briefs were filed that a decision was issued, a proposed decision by the administrative law judge. And then shortly thereafter, the decision was approved by the full commission. So thank you for your time. And I did want to just wrap up by saying that it is a very robust and transparent process to ensure that there's adequate funding for decommissioning at Diablo Canyon. Are there any questions?
Great, thank you. Does the panel have any questions? Frank.
I do. I know currently PG&E, they collect a fee towards this effort of the decommissioning of Diablo. At what point does that cease to be billed?
So that fee would cease once the trust fund is fully funded based on the decommissioning cost estimate for Diablo Canyon.
So it can be ongoing past the decommissioning date of 2025?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Kara?
I'm just curious, you had mentioned that the last filing in 2016 took 14 months to prepare. Do you feel like you're on track for the submission by March of 2019?
Yes, we do.
So you've already started it before today.
Yes.
You've been, okay.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Sherry, did you have a question?
No.
Oh, okay. Anyone else? Oh, Linda?
I have two short questions. The trust fund, you mentioned that PG&E manages the trust fund, right? Who manages the trust fund?
I believe, I don't know the answer to that question.
I can answer that.
Okay.
And I don't remember the name of the firm, but we oversee the management of the trust fund. The actual oversight includes oversight by our board of directors, but we have a professional investment company that manages the trust fund for us. Now, that is subject to CPUC review to ensure that we're doing it in a manner that best supports, you know, the customer's interests.
Okay. And then, thank you. The second question, you mentioned expedited dry cask loading. Could you explain that?
Yeah, so the CPUC order asked us to investigate the time frame that Southern California Edison is utilizing, and their time frame is 7. Our previous estimate looked at a decade for cooling cycles in the used fuel pool, and that becomes critical path for other activities associated with decommissioning, and that translates to the customer in a longer carrying cost. So the last order from the Utilities Commission on their decision this year, the last NDTCP stated, please benchmark San Onofre's 7-year schedule and see if you can match that. So we'll be in the process of doing that as well.
Nancy?
I think it'd be useful for everyone to hear if there are adequate funds now, and if not, how much are we falling short?
We don't believe there are now, but we're making a transition from what's called a generic estimate, which is an industry average based on volume for the 2-unit station like we have. But this time we're transitioning to a site-specific estimate. So it'll be affected in a couple of ways. One, what do we actually have on site? Two, what are our actual regulatory requirements in California versus the generic average? And then three, drivers like that fuel time we just mentioned will affect that ultimate cost. And then the fourth thing that we're contemplating that wasn't in the previous estimates is if there is repurposing, those repurposed items, if we're not paying for the demolition and removal of, would help reduce the overall cost. Mr. Nelson will talk a little bit more about that in his presentation. That's the next presentation that's up.
It's probably worth noting to the panel and the community, the funds we're talking about are not funds that the company gains any value from. There's no profit margin. This is funds that are provided by our customers to pay for decommissioning. There's no profit involved there. There's no percentage. So our goal, quite frankly, is to reduce those costs to our customer in a manner that still meets the technical and prudent and proper way of completing decommissioning at a cost that is the best cost for our customers. There is no profit.
David.
Yeah, so right now PG&E estimates that there's a shortfall in the amount of money. Is that attributed to, I know in the last 20 years we've had a couple major market collapses, or does PG&E have other reasons they believe that there's a shortfall in the amount of money?
In our last filing, we felt, for instance, that the amount that was allocated for security was insufficient for some of the potential out-of-state waste disposal issues were a cost driver, and we've been ordered to re-examine those costs. The trust fund over time has performed well. It's authorized for its collection to be around $2.4 billion, and its performance is north of $2.7 billion. So over time, there have been ebbs and flows to it, like you suggest, based on market forces, but the investment strategies have proven to be pretty sound.
Alex?
Yeah, in terms of the adequacy or inadequacy of the trust fund, I think it's important to point out that I believe that at least the last time you went through the triennial proceeding, PG&E asked for approximately $3.5 billion, if I got it right, to do the decommissioning, and they had a decommissioning cost estimate. And the PUC looked at that and said, wait a second, you haven't really shown that these costs are necessary. We're going to sharpen our pencils and reevaluate. And they came up with a cost that was $2.5 billion, I think it was. And so PUC believes that that $2.5 billion is adequate. PG&E, you know, may think, well, we wanted more. We wanted more money. But as far as PUC, who is the authoritative regulator on this matter, PG&E has adequate funds to decommission the plant, and they can come back in this time. In fact, that's what we want them to do, to more fully explain and justify any additional costs that may be needed. And we would support that fully, and we want to do that. But as far as the regulator is concerned, they believe PUC has adequate funds. And, oh, by the way, NRC regulates this very carefully and very heavily as well. And if NRC thought they didn't have adequate funds to cover this, they would be on top of them immediately. And NRC seems to think they're okay. So I would suggest that, you know, as far as the regulators are concerned, they have to maintain adequate funds, and they do have adequate funds. Now, I have a question. Sorry. For Deanna, I guess. Let's go back to page 10, if we could, of your slides. In that one, you said something about the lands issues. It's not a bullet there, but could you repeat what you said there, Deanna?
I believe I was referring to the fact that we would include an estimate of costs for completing the public stakeholder process prior to disposition of Diablo Canyon's facilities and surrounding lands.
Right. And no, this is not the time or place. So we've talked, John and I have talked, Tom, the whole panel has talked briefly about that issue. Perhaps we ought to put it at a different point to this evening. And I don't expect you guys to have an answer for this one. But I think it's important to point out that in January of this year, the PUC, in approving the retirement of Diablo Canyon, mandated and ordered PG&E to set up a process. They said PG&E will not dispose of the lands and take no action regarding the lands until, quote, completion of a process, including a public stakeholder process. And so this panel is part of that process, I suppose, and a very important question that you guys are going to be working on and give us an answer on the website, hopefully, which says, when do you think that, how do you interpret that phrase, that completion of a process? What process are we completing? Because there's many, many processes going on here. What process do you mean, and when do you think it's going to be complete? Because at that moment, whenever it is, presumably PG&E can dispose of the lands and at least be free of that commitment. So we probably want to get clarification on that point. And it's not something to do today, but this process is part of the process which ultimately helps evaluate what's going to happen with the lands.
So that's a specific question you'd like PG&E to respond to.
Yeah, and they know that, and we're going to work on it.
Thank you for your question, Alex. It's probably worthwhile talking just very briefly about it. What has occurred is in our last filing, associated with the joint proposal, we as part of that filing, we proposed a public process like this. As Alex indicated, the commission codified our recommendation for a community engagement panel, and this panel is exactly that. It's in order to gain transparency and interaction with the community because the lands issue is so important.
Right.
It's always... And being an interesting and exciting issue, we want to rush to a decision, okay? But the reality is, you know, the plant's going to continue to operate through 2025. And subsequent to that, there's a number of years to get the fuel in dry storage and to start the decommissioning of the facility. So much of the land is really going to be under the control of that activity for many years. We want what I would characterize this engagement panel is a start of a long conversation with the community to get their input, to gain the insight of how the community sees this wonderful resource to be used in the future. Some of those lands we may be able to deal with earlier and some later, but none in any soon activity. These are all decisions that will take years to finalize, and we're lucky and fortunate to be able to have an opportunity like this to have a good, rich discussion with the community prior to making those decisions.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you all. One more question,
one quick
Frank.
Question. Is there some place that we would be able to see if the funding that you suggest is there to do the decommissioning, what is that funding attributed to? Is there a budget of some sort that shows where certain money goes to?
We're going to learn more about that tonight,
okay.
Frank. Recognize that in a couple elements of the funding, the money has been provided by our customers over the years that the plant has operated. We believe that funding is best provided by those customers that benefit from the generation provided by the facility. So we would like to provide cost estimates that lead to funding decisions that will provide the funding necessary by the time the plant shuts down. At Humboldt Bay, we're continuing to get some funds from the customers, and that plant's been shut down for many years. So it's very important that we develop a very good cost estimate. We're going to hear more about that later tonight. And that cost estimate that the company provides becomes the basis for our filing that Deanna spoke to. And then that filing is reviewed by the commission, and the decision to recover those funds from our customers are made by the CPUC.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you all. Our next speaker or presenter is going to talk about planning. And this discussion was a great segue into that, this presentation. Eric Nelson is the director of the Diablo Canyon Decommissioning Projects and oversees the creation of the new cost estimate, known as the Nuclear Decommissioning Cost Triennial Proceeding. Eric has an extensive project management background and has been with PG&E for over 25 years. Eric?
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity to talk tonight. So what I'm going to do is talk about how we're going through the process of developing the site-specific decommissioning cost estimate. And it really is PG&E's obligation to submit a thorough cost estimate to the CPUC to be able to justify the funds that we are looking for to complete decommissioning. So what is a site-specific decommissioning cost estimate? Well, because if you look in our plant's history, we have been planning actively for relicensing for quite some time. So our previous filings and the triennial process have been done using an industry generic estimate and tool and vendor. And we've done that because that really has sort of been the industry standard. So it might take a look at what does it take to decommission a standard 2-unit pressurized water reactor of a certain size. And that's how really the estimate is developed. Now, there is some site-specific information put into that, some things specific to Diablo Canyon. But it's really the basis is much more of an industry generic one. And we have... Since we filed the last submittal, we now know when we want to start decommissioning. We want to start to go into decommissioning immediately after cessation of operation of the plant. which leads me to the sub-bullet. Again, our preferred approach is to go on with DECON, which is immediate dismantling and decommissioning, as opposed to the Safe Store auction. And Tom Jones did a good job of going through that last time. So how are we going to go about that? And again, part of the reason we want to go into, I want to be clear, part of the reason we want to go into decommissioning immediately is, one, is it's an overall has lower costs to the PG&E customers. Two is it allows us to get a better transition of the knowledgeable folks at Diablo Cane and take advantage of those resources and that knowledge base as we transition immediately into decommissioning. And quite frankly, part of the reason the panel is here is that the sooner we go into that, the sooner we can complete decommissioning and to be able to really do whatever we are going to do with the future land. Whatever the future land use determines to be, we can get there sooner. So those are some of the main reasons we really want to go into decommissioning immediately. So we're going to be doing this as opposed to an industry generic estimate. We're really building this from the ground up. What does it take to decommission Diablo Canyon specifically? And that really takes into account what are some of our regulatory requirements. We have a dual unit site. We have a common spent fuel pill building. We have a lot of intricacies associated specifically to Diablo Canyon. And we're in the beautiful state of California, which comes with its own permitting requirements and disposal requirements and things like that. So that's really how we're building up that estimate. Now, we've taken some really high-quality folks from the plant to help us with that. But we also recognize that we have used Lauren Sharp and his team's expertise at Humboldt Bay to help inform us. But we've also used industry subject matter experts. We've gone out and said, who's done decommissioning? Who's helped develop estimates to really get a good cross-section of knowledge to better bolster, one, the quality of the estimate, and two, to be able to demonstrate to the CPC, because it had been something raised by them before, that we were really doing a sort of a PG&E internal estimate, and we really wanted to get more external expertise. So we've really done a good job of that. And on top of that, we're also getting third-party reviews of some of the more critical items. Like, as an example, we have a contractor helping us to develop the specific security cost estimates that were an issue with the CPC. We talked about that a few minutes ago. And then we're going to have a third-party person take a look at that. So we want to get that extra layer of oversight. And then we come to really, you know, the what we call the public stakeholder process that Alex described earlier. So this is, you know, the engagement panel and the public input. So I'm going to use one specific example, something we can sort of all coalesce in our minds, I hope, is that we talk about something called the marina at Diablo Canyon. What's really, the marina is really, there's a boat dock down there, there's the two large breakwaters, okay, that exist down there. And right now, what we are going to submit is a cost estimate that shows us removing all of that breakwater, because we need to do that because that's consistent with, it's really consistent with the CPC order, but it's also consistent with the lease under which we were able to build the plant. So we need to put together a cost estimate that accurately reflects what it takes us to comply with our requirements. Having said that, that to me and to most of is an opportunity for repurposing. So that breakwater could continue to stay there. It could act, you know, could be part of a research. It could be used as a safe harbor for those people like me who kayak, who boat. Could be used for that opportunity. So what would that do? Well, if we did that, that one would eliminate the cost of having to do that portion of decommissioning, which is into a couple $100 million probably of total costs. So that saves the PG&E customers money. Two is it repurposes that and uses that for really beneficial uses going forward. And three is we've done the calculations now, and this is part of that site, doing the site-specific cost estimate, and we've determined that the amount of concrete associated with the two breakwaters is greater than the total concrete for the rest of Diablo Canyon and its structures combined. So if you think about how many truckloads of, or however you want to get out, of concrete that is to try and remove, it's massive. So the environmental impact of taking all of that out, plus the impact of removing all of that, there's an opportunity there that with working with the public input process, we might be able to find a sort of a win-win-win for everybody. So that's really kind of my goal for the, you know, the public stakeholder process. And again, from a transparency standpoint, I just want to be clear, our 2018 NDCTP submittal will include the full costs of removal, because we know that we're not going to have agreements on how we might disposition the land or have a future land use for that. We're going to put in the submittal how we intend to go through that process. We'll describe how we're working with the communities on that, but we're going to need to put in to comply with the CPUC orders and to comply with our lease. We're going to put that full cost in there. And we'll have, and I'll talk a minute about other opportunities to perhaps refresh that cost estimate. So, which is a good lead in to what's the 2018 NDCTP approval? Well, this is a super critical submittal for us because it's really the transition from the industry generic estimates to the site-specific decommissioning cost estimate. But it does some other things. Having that detailed project description in this submittal and getting approval allows us to move forward with detailed project descriptions that we're going to need for permitting. So permitting is going to take a long time. You know, Tom Jones at the prior meeting talked about how long, look at the swim lanes and how long that permitting process takes. That's important. And we're also allows us to proceed with Nuclear Regulatory Commission licensing efforts. So we are going to have to, whether it's submitting exceptions or whether it's submitting license amendment requests, we're going to have to do those to implement effective decommissioning. And part of our 2018 NDCT submittal is going to include requests for cost recovery for funds that we need to do that planning process, to the planning process from 2019 through 2024, so we can be prepared to effectively go right into decommissioning and so we can have that process planned out so it's the most effective process that it can be. So there's a larger gap in the 2018 from where we are now to where we need to go in 2018. In 2021, we're also going to be submitting another update. So as part of the triennial process, we're going to be updating that with available results of licensing, permitting, and repurposing approvals. And in addition, there's also regulation changes going on right now. They're in process with the NRC that affect specifically around decommissioning. So there may be changes in the regulations associated with decommissioning that we're going to need to factor in. So that'll be part of the 2021 NDCT submittal. And then in 2024, we sort of have the last chance before we start into the decommissioning process. So it's really our last chance before the licenses expire. And then we're going to include in that submittal results. We should have some issued permits from there, talking about permitting conditions and really the licensing approval. So that's really our last opportunity to submit that just prior to entering into decommissioning. So again, from a key takeaway standpoint, we're engaging the public, and part of the public is an engagement panel, talking about the industry, getting industry expertise to help us with the development of the cost estimate, and really third-party reviews to help refine that, to help build a successful decommissioning plan that we're going to submit to the CPUC to justify the costs that we believe we need to do effective decommissioning. And again, after this critical 2018 submittal, we'll have two additional opportunities to update that. And again, reiterating that our preferred approach is to go straight into decommissioning. And with that, thank you for your time. And I'd like to open it up to any questions you guys might have.
Thank you, Eric. Panel members, any questions? Okay, Frank and then Lauren.
If I understand correctly, 2021 is where the repurposing approvals, based upon that scenario you gave about the breakwater, that would be determined?
So that's a good question. I wouldn't commit to that. Here's what I can say is that in 2018, when we do the submittal, we know we won't have time to reach the agreements and determine how we would reach, you know, if there's like a lease change or a regulation change or something we would need to do to implement whatever agreements we want to do. 2021 would represent really the first opportunity if we have any of those agreements reached to do that. What I was talking about in terms of the 2021 is when we go through the permitting process, so we're going to have to get permitting to get that done. We should be able to, in that update, the submittal that we do with the results of that permitting, where we are in that process, how far along we are with respect to any licensing submittals that we're doing with the NRC. But that would be, I would think, and I'm getting a little far out of my field, but that would be really the first opportunity if there had been any decisions made that we would provide it as part of the submittal, part of the triennial submittal process.
So at that time frame, you'd probably be hearing if there is interest in doing something in that regard, but no final approval would be made at that point.
Correct. And this is Tom Jones. And also, on the condition of our current lease with the California State Lands Commission, we have to give them an update on our decommissioning plans by mid-2020. So it'd be a year in front of that submittal as well. And just keep in mind the time frame. While it's the 2021 submittal, it would likely be on the cadence in March of 2022, right? So the year on the application is a year in front of usually when it's submitted.
Thank you very much.
Lauren and then Alex.
I understand that on this 2018 filing, you have to put into the filing the assumption that you're going to have to, like, take out the marina or things like that. So my question is, what's the history of the CPUC in terms of flexibility in entertaining modifications of previous filings? So if you go to them in 2021 and with a plan to modify that, are they typically completely open to considering that, or does it sort of, are they prejudiced to stick with what you previously outlined?
So to answer your question, I would say that they will examine the record for that particular proceeding, and if there is new information that is compelling, they can potentially change their direction. Does that answer your question?
If we come with a cost reduction, they're going to want to hear that. So
okay.
Okay. Thank you, Alex, and then Linda.
Yeah, a follow-up to that. I mean, I think we should point out that the last triennial proceeding decision by PUC in June of 2017, just about a year ago, PG&E came in with a specific proposal, site-specific proposal for the removal of the marina and all of the riprap and the concrete associated with that. You said that it would cost $312 million to take all that material and ship it off the site through Avila, out of state, to some out of state disposal facility. And PUC said, not so fast. You have not shown that any of that is necessary. So, A, that was a site-specific proposal, and it was for $312 million. And what PUC said, well, you haven't proven that that's required at all. We see that there's an executive order out there of some couple decades ago. It doesn't seem like that's being enforced. PG&E needs to go back to all those regulators and dot the I's, cross the T's, and answer the question, does California law really require that stuff to be shipped out of state and off-site? Because it's a scary scenario you've painted, which is, oh, my God, thousands and thousands of trucks are going to go through Avila Beach. But the PUC says, wait a second, we haven't seen how that's needed at all. And until you can show us that there's a necessity for that, we're not going to give you $312 million or cause the ratepayers to pay $312 million. So this is, and that's what PG&E is going to try to do now, revise the site-specific proposal and say, you know, either you say we don't have to do it or we do have to do it, and here's what our best estimate of the costs are. So it's not sort of, well, either we remove all the stuff or we repurpose it. The first step is obviously this one coming up in the next submission, which is answer PUC's questions, which are directing you to go to those agencies and answer, do they really require that stuff to be torn out and shipped out of sight or not? Mm-hmm. Have you focused on that, Eric?
We have, and so that consultation, some informal, has begun, and we'll have through March of next year to complete that. However, I would suggest to you that the lease from the State Lands Commission was exceptionally clear that all items without their affirmative decision must be removed, and we don't have authorization for that. So those parameters we felt weren't, while we entered in the record, weren't considered, so we're going to bolster that with further consultation. But again, on PG&E's own volition, we simply have to pursue removal because we don't have the authorization to leave in place.
Well, state lands may require the removal of the marina, but it doesn't mean all the stuff has to be shipped off-site and out of state. That is a different issue that the PUC balked at and said, you haven't proven that, so we're not going to give you $312 million.
Well, that's correct, but they balked at both, the removal and then the disposal path.
Yeah.
I will suggest also that Southern California Edison has arrived at that decision, and their cost estimate does include shipping out of state. So that seems to be in the proceeding as well, from another proceeding.
Okay.
Good.
Thank you. Linda.
At the breakwater, or where the outflow pipe is that called the breakwater?
It's the discharge?
That's the discharge structure. The breakwater really is really there to protect the inlet, so that the outfall is on be on the northern
but
side.
But isn't the outfall, isn't there a big pile of rocks there too?
There's a staircase that goes out. No, so there's not a breakwater like a jetty like you might be thinking of.
No,
there's
okay.
a staircase that goes out into the intertidal zone a very short distance, and that's just to absorb the energy from the water so it doesn't scour out the bay.
Okay.
But that's a radically smaller structure than the intake.
Okay. So my question is, do you sample the bottom and the rocks to see if they have radiation?
Huh? Lauren will take that one later. As part of his presentation.
Yes.
In my presentation.
It'll be covered in the future.
And then the other question is about the license amendments. Do you know what they're going to be yet? Are you already thinking about what
yes.
license amendments you're applying for? And how could we find out what they are?
The answer is we have a very specific and have very specific knowledge of exactly which ones we intend to submit, and I'll turn it over to Tom in terms of how you'll get access to that.
Okay.
So that's our intention now. So, for instance, something like if we were to pursue a spent fuel pool island like Southern California Edison did that would reduce our dependence on ocean water for cooling, that would require a license amendment request. So there are amendments like that because we have to show that the measures we're taking are effective prior to implementation, so that would require approval. So that's an example of the type of license amendment request we'd pursue.
Mm-hmm. And then how do we find out what they are?
We have a list in the project schedule, so we can develop that. And
we can develop that and figure out a way of providing that.
Great.
And Linda, remember that any NRC license amendment would go through the license amendment process.
Right.
It's a public process that would be engaged with the NRC.
And I would say also that part of the permitting and the licensing is really a lot of the thrust that's going to be done. We plan to do between 2019 and 2024. And because that process takes so long and because it has the appropriate public input and that process takes a while, that's part of our filing. It's going to be in 2018 to say we really want to make sure we have the time and the resources to be able to do that so we can really save the PG&E customers money. Because if we go do a more effective planning job in decommissioning, we can really do a better job of implementation.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. One more question, Kara.
It's more of a comment. I just wanted to mention, both at the last public meeting and this meeting, the issues of the fate of the land that surrounds the plant, how facilities might be refurbished or reused by others always comes up, and there are issues that are extremely important to this community. And so I just wanted to remind everyone that there will be two meetings devoted just to the land and reuse questions. So at the end of August and again at the end of September, We're going to really devote both of those meetings to these topics, so anybody who's interested should be encouraged to attend those meetings. We're also going to be scheduling some opportunity for people to take tours of the land during those months, and there may be some additional public workshops. So even though we keep touching on these issues, there's going to be a really, I think, a great opportunity for people to have a lot of chance to say what they think the outcome of the land and the facilities might be.
And so stay tuned. Kara, I'd like to say that those two meetings you mentioned are two meetings this year. You know, we're going to continue, I'm sure, on this topic over future years as well.
Thank you all. And thank you, Kara, for reminding us that. Our next presenter is going to talk about decommissioning approvals and future state. And as PG&E Director of Strategic Initiatives, Tom Jones oversees the regulatory and engagement strategies for the decommissioning process. He works collaboratively across PG&E lines of business to ensure that the project and the company are aligned. Tom?
Thanks, Chuck. So tonight I'm going to focus on some of the key state regulatory drivers that will be cascading from what we hope to be a successful estimate or NDTCP filing. It's not going to go into detail in the license amendments, but rather the main drivers from the state perspective. Okay. So we have a couple of main drivers. One is the California Environmental Quality Act, CEQA. And this is a framework in which we operate. All projects in California operate to provide information to public agencies and decision makers, and it seeks to identify and reduce impacts to the project through alternatives and mitigation. So, for instance, when Eric had mentioned that there might be some approvals, if we think about the schedule when we could submit, and we'll talk about that in a few minutes, potentially in 21 or 2022 for these discretionary permits from the state, some of these alternatives to the land use will be included in those in that CEQA process. So your project description describes everything you wish to do, and there's some alternative analysis in there. So at that time, all of those types of impacts and public policy trade-offs would be evaluated. That will result in something called Environmental Impact Report. That's the master document. Think of that as the umbrella from which all future permits, something as simple as a grading permit, would be included in that overall analysis of the project. And again, just like the Nuclear Regulatory Commission process or the CPUC process, all of these are rigorous public participation processes as well. The other one is the California Coastal Act. Most of the plant, but not all of the site, is in the coastal zone. So when we did, for instance, our 2008 steam generator replacement project, and Mr. Meacham was then Supervisor Meacham, when those things came through, most of that was in the coastal zone, but areas inland were only subject to county purview under a conditional use permit. So that's one of the things that complicates why we're not certain of what the lead CEQA agency will be yet. And the last thing about the Coastal Act I'd like to mention is the original jurisdiction. So there's two other players that come in once we hit the tideline. So the county, while it has a local coastal program, and that's for the terrestrial areas, once we get into the marine environment, the Coastal Commission will have original jurisdiction. So things like the breakwater, things like the discharge structure will be in their purview. And then lastly, it's also a CEQA alternative under the law, or equal under the law. So you can have analysis done under the Coastal Act or under the Environmental Quality Act, and they're determined equal under California state law. When we do that, there's two levels of analysis. There's a project-level analysis and environmental impact report, and that's very specific information. For instance, if you're talking about the demolition of the building, it would talk about the excavation, the type of backfill on the soils, what type of trucks you would use, what are their emissions, what the disposal location would be, all of those types of things. You also have the opportunity of something called programmatic, and that's more of a global view when you're not quite ready to determine all of those specific activities, but you want to frame the issue and get approval to approve the next step. We foresee a blended approach where we make both project and programmatic filings at the same time. And as an update to the panel, the draft environmental impact report was issued this afternoon at 2 o'clock for the San Onofre decommissioning. And it's a 706-page document, and it has a fair amount. It'll give you a good idea of what we'll be looking at. I would suggest you our project will be even a little more complex because of the repurposing standards, the repurposing ideas that might come, and also that we're, again, not just a coastal project, but we have some inland things as well. When we look at that program level, again, it's just the broad policy perspectives. It's the conceptual framework, and then subsequent regulatory proceedings and applications will be covered under that. And so I think of this as, you think about this large complex project over time, you know some things up front you're going to want to do, and then you have concepts or ideas. So you get approval, you execute the work. Some things might change, like technologies, for instance. We might have a way to reduce emissions. Other things can change over time. So you have that second and third phasing of the project, and you want to keep narrowing or closing that gap and keep moving forward on the project and keep securing approvals. And that gives you the most efficient path and gives also probably the most accurate information for decision makers to act upon. And so some of those important considerations, sometimes we hear, well, we'll just do this or that and take our time, but there's a concept called piecemeal under the Environmental Quality Act, and you can't take little bits and pieces of your project and do it. You need to have that fulsome overview to begin with, and then anything you wish to do must fall under that umbrella. So that's why you can have both the programmatic and the project level analysis going on, so that you keep everything inside. And if you have to reframe that issue, that's the advantage to the phasing project, because if it's not in your project description and it hasn't been analyzed, you can't do it. So that's really the important thing to keep in mind here. And again, the Coastal Act is a CEQA alternative under the law. So here's an example timeline of what we're talking about. I know in our previous meeting we talked about our swim lanes, and we have these concurrent regulatory approvals. You see on that track, you know, a state lands process for a couple of years, a Coastal Commission process for a couple of years, the county and the NRC licensing process. All of that is represented in this first box to the left called the approval phase. So we think about the approval of this NDTCP that we're talking about tonight, and Eric's team gets the estimate informed, and my team has the permitting ready to go. We then submit for those discretionary permits, and around 2020 is what our schedule shows now. We know that to be a 3 to 4 year process, and then let's assume we get that. During that approval phase, on that bar graph on your left to right, you can see it falls under the timeline. So we show the approval process from 2020 through 2025. And then during that, we'd be submitting for two things: a programmatic level description of all of the activities and a project level description for things we wanted to execute beginning in 2025. So in just a minute, I have a visual picture of the power plant site, and we'll color code it to these colors. So just keep in mind, blue would be immediate action, green would be the second phase, and there's actually a third phase, which is what do you do with dry cask storage, which we contemplate right now to remain longer than the plant, or breakwater slash marina demolition or repurposing. Okay. And so here's a project phasing that includes all three. So you can see the timeline just drags out. And again, it's quite a long time frame. I believe at the end of phase three, I'm 103 years old. So, you know, again, to John's point about the pacing in the project, this is a multi-billion dollar, multi-decade project. But we want to get the bulk of those activities completed in 2035 or sooner, 2037 or sooner. And so what that looks like is, here's the site. So that phase one that would go in for submission in around 2020 would be all of these blue areas here. So the bulk of the power plant site, all the way from basically when you come down the hill into the station, all the way through the power block, it would include the 230,000 volt or 230 kV switch yard. That's a fill location. We would actually use some of that material on site to fill in some other excavations to reduce truck trips and bringing in other soils, right? We think about those impacts. This is a way to help reduce the scope of the project on site. We would also look at these areas back here. And this is this old steam generator storage facility I mentioned from the 2008 project. This is outside of the coastal zone. The coastal zone boundary is right about in the middle of the switch yard. Okay. And then I look at that phase two. Right now, for estimating purposes, we would have that demolition for costing reasons in phase two. And then in phase three would be the dry cask storage and is a support facility here. This is our security firing and training range. And as long as we have the security requirements, we would keep the ancillary support facility. And so this is about the size of this building, right? If you look at a footprint. But we would have those two in that phase three submittal that then would look for execution in that 2070, 2072 timeframe. So again, this submittal phase happens while the plant's still operating. We don't consider the site available for project until after 2025 when the plant stops to operate based on the current plans. So the key takeaways, all of the work I just described is predicated that we meet our burden and we satisfy the regulator and that we're in a position to get in there and do that work. And we know what it is based on our third-party expertise that we didn't have last time for this much stronger site-specific estimate. And that the CEQA process allows for that evaluation of alternatives, and there will also be a host of technical studies that we'll need to do around submission for the for those projects as well. And this slide, you know, I drafted this last week, and as I mentioned, while we were guessing it would be the next quarter, it was issued today, the San Onofre draft environmental impact report. Lastly, our team will do an analysis of that report, and we've sent you the link already so you can evaluate on your own, but we're going to benchmark that and also offer peer technical review to our sister utility. Be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions of Tom? Alex?
Yeah, could we go to the slide 27, page 27? That's a time frame, and I think I understand a lot of it. At the, you know, and here's one of the things. We were talking about the CEQA process.
Correct.
And on page 23, you say that there's also the CDP process. Mm-hmm. So that this, you know, there's a CEQA process, and then there's a coastal development permit, CDP,
correct,
process. And you're indicating that that can, in some areas, serve in lieu of the CEQA process. Is that right?
Yeah, they're companions.
Right. Well, okay, then we go to the page 27, and it's talking about the CDP submittal. You see at the bottom, April 2020. And what is that? I take it that's something that PG&E submits to somebody to the for this a CD this is submitted by PG&E.
Correct. So, for instance, if we submitted just a coastal development permit to the California Coastal Commission, they would do their analysis under the Coastal Act only. If we submitted that same coastal development permit to the County of San Luis Obispo, they would use the CEQA process. And so they're companion processes, but they're not fully aligned. It's like a really tightly overlapped Venn diagram, but slightly different authority, slightly different analysis, slightly different process.
So are you going to submit this, the CEQA materials at the same time or at a different time?
I would see us doing one filing. So for instance, or one, we would file everything we needed to at one time. So for instance, when we filed our license renewal application in 2009, we filed we filed with the Coastal Commission as well for their ancillary review to support the NRC process. We did that on the same day.
Okay, so again, so the kind of question I have is when, timing of when, and this slide helps somewhat, when will the CEQA / CDP process occur in this sense? Presumably, PG&E has to submit a bunch of materials, a big hundreds and hundreds of pages long sort of submission. But that's not the EIR. That's because the agency issues the EIR.
Correct. That initiates that process.
Right. That the agency requires you to submit something as a prerequisite to them doing a draft EIR. When do you think, if you submit things in April 2020, that the agencies would generate a draft EIR for public comment?
I would anticipate 2 to 3 years. So, for instance, the Southern California Edison draft that came out today was based on an application that was submitted in 2015.
Okay, so the public comment on the CEQA CDP would be April of 2023?
There's... It depends
on
which process.
I mean, I'm just trying to get a ballpark idea of when the public gets to weigh in on that.
There's a number of steps along the way, and that's driven by the agency. So, for instance, they can do workshops before the area is contemplated. Then they issue a draft environmental impact report. There's a public comment window for that. That then closes, and the agency must address that comment. And then they would prepare their staff report for the hearing. So in the case, let's take the San Luis Obispo County track. You would have the Planning Commission hearing. You would have the workshops in front of that. you would have the Planning Commission take some action, and I would assume a likely appeal to the County Board of Supervisors, and then you would have those appeal those issues before the board, and then I would also assume, for my scheduling purposes, an appeal from the San Luis Obispo County Board of Supervisors to the California Coastal Commission, which could start the analysis over.
Does that, all of those things you just mentioned, do they occur before the agency issues a draft EIR or after?
In the case of San Luis Obispo that I mentioned, the draft EIR would be in front of the Planning Commission. They would use the certified EIR for their decision-making.
Okay.
And then the Board of Supervisors would rely on that document as well.
So all these things are going to happen after April 2023.
Right. Okay. So that's why we show a 4 to 5 year time window for that approval.
Okay. Right. And that's right before 2024 when the first unit is ceases operation.
That's correct. There's a lot of work to do, and I look at it as that's why this NDTCP is so important, so that we have a good, thorough project description so that I don't get in a do loop where I don't have enough information to satisfy one of my regulators downstream.
Yeah, I'm just thinking the CEQA CDP process as far as public involvement, other than this panel perhaps, is 2025. I'm 2023, a long time.
Yeah, a long time.
5 years.
Many, many opportunities, both at the comment process during the creation of the documents and the hearing process.
Okay.
Thank you, Alex. Sherry, and then Linda.
Yeah, Tom, I'm not sure what is meant by the CDP is a CEQA alternative under California law.
Oh, it should say equivalent. So the California Coastal Commission has their own process that's the equivalent under CEQA, but they don't have to follow all the same rules that, for instance, the county does. That's what I'm trying to point out.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Linda, and then Frank, and then Nancy.
I seem to remember that the State Lands Commission also was going to require an EIS or an EIR when the plant shut down. Is that right, or am I not remembering that correctly?
What they've required is our decommissioning plan to be submitted by 2020, and this estimate will, we think, serve that purpose, but we'll be in consultation with that group. If they're the lead CEQA agency, they would then run the EIR process. That hasn't been determined yet which agency will be the overall lead.
So there will be one EIR. There won't be multiple.
I think there will be multiple EIRs, but one at a time. So when I talked about those phases, there could be a supplemental environmental impact report when we move those later phases from programmatic to project. But we would like to get a consolidated approach and deal with one lead agency and then have other commenting agencies. That's the goal. So, for instance, in Southern California Edison, because they're not part of a local coastal program area and they're on federal land, the state's land commission has taken the lead. Here, we could have the opportunity to have the county do it. The Public Utilities Commission actually did it for our steam generator environmental impact report, or you could have the state lands commission do it. So there are some different options, and the jurisdictions overlap. So it's not a clear, simple answer like you're building a house in San Simeon, for instance. Okay.
But the coastal commission, could they do it?
They could. The county has a local coastal program, so there is a legal avenue where they could agree on a consolidated approach, but the county would be waiving some rights, and so I don't, you know, that would be a county decision if they would want to look for that expedited or consolidated process.
Okay. Thank you.
Nancy, and then I think
Tom.
It was Frank.
Can you elaborate a little bit on the alternative analysis that CEQA does?
Your mic's not on.
Oh. Can you elaborate a little bit on the alternative analysis that CEQA does and maybe give some examples? For example, is that when they determine things like how the concrete is trucked out or whether or not the marina should be removed? And
that's exactly
what are some
correct.
Examples? Okay.
So there's everything from the project you propose to different things that they might respond to for public comment, or the agency might have their own ideas. And there's also something called the no project alternative that CEQA looks at. Like, what happens if you do nothing? Well, if you do nothing, everything stays in place, right? So that's probably not a viable alternative in this instance. that would satisfy the public policy goals of California. So an alternative analysis could be, for instance, waste shipping. It might say, we understand you're looking at trucking. You could look at a combination of truck and rail. You could look at some supplemental barging. It would evaluate those issues and see what's the best outcome, and then decision makers would ultimately rule on that. They'd have to make findings that support their decision.
Just one other comment is that it seems so strange that you have to come up with your cost before you really have this analysis of what's the best method.
So that's the importance that Eric's slide laid out tonight of the 2018 will reduce that gap, but then the 2021 and 2024 filings will be further informed by these permit processes. So we're going to keep narrowing down and learning more, right? So we just want to keep reducing uncertainty and improving the plan for the overall project over the filings, both on the environmental front and the financial front with the Utilities Commission. So just keep thinking, we're just trying to get closer, narrow, understand, agree, closer, narrow, understand, agree, and fund. That's the approach.
Frank, David, did you have a comment too? Did you want to comment? Okay, Frank.
Tom, if I understand correctly, I was looking at page 24. After certification of the EIR with the lead agency, we don't have a lead agency at this point?
That's correct.
Okay. And then also, if you're looking at page 27, as you get out, let's say you get out to 2035, and all of a sudden something develops to where there's a project or something that's being proposed, that's going to extend the time of an EIR, or will it be a supplemental EIR based upon whatever that project would be?
I suggest it would be a supplemental filing. If you mentioned 2035 or 2037. I wouldn't begin work without a certified EIR, you know, a decade upstream. But there's going to be changes over time, right? This is an incredibly complex process. And also, when we're doing this over the lifespan, I like to think, Ms. Danoff and I were talking about this earlier tonight, you know, the legislature has the opportunity to improve or change the rules every year, as does the regulatory bodies can promulgate new regulations.
All right.
So the standard with which we're approaching this today, I would hope, is at that 90-10 level. But we know some things will change over time. I'm sure the Coastal Act will be modified between now and then, and I'm sure there will be other changes to CEQA between now and then, and air emission standards are likely to change. So that's why once we get closer, we'll have those filings and get some certainty and hopefully have the permits in hand by 2024, and then those will really inform that 2024 filing with the Utilities Commission for cost.
I see.
Yeah.
And as I look at the around 2050, I hope I'm looking down to see this project being done as opposed to looking up and not.
One last question on this topic. David?
Is that on? There we go. With regard to the 2016 NDCTP, how was it presented? Is it presented as both a safe store versus decon and the two cost scenarios? Is that how PG&E would present?
Yes.
And it sounds clear that PG&E's choice is to move in the decon direction.
Correct.
Which I would support too. But so looking at, I guess Humboldt's not a good example because they went into safe store, but for Songs, for instance, how did, repurposing is being presented as a cost savings, or at least that's how it sounds from most of the discussion I've heard so far. So how was repurposing addressed for Songs, or was it? I don't know what their facility's like compared to Diablo.
It's a little different. They're on a leasehold from the Department of the Navy, and they also don't have a clear NEPA standard, National Environmental Policy Act standard, from what the Navy's expecting as well. So they have a multi-phase project. Their phasing, I believe, is 6 or 7 phases as opposed to the 3 we're postulating right now. And their site doesn't lend itself to the same type of repurposing. It's a very, very small site that's very constrained.
Because
they're on 85 acres total.
Today you
like
seem
that.
To talk mostly about the intake, not the structure, but the breakwater for repurposing. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of other facilities of Diablo too that we've talked briefly about in
Correct.
Our other meetings. So those would be on the table, I would imagine,
right.
Also, right?
And the sites are just very unique. Their site is very constrained. They don't have near the parking that we do. They don't have the same support infrastructure. And if anyone's visited the site, it's kind of like a treehouse. I mean, it's vertical, right? You'll go up and down staircases. It's truly for a power plant. It doesn't lend itself to those
things. And there's one very specific difference is it's on Navy land, and Navy wants to use all that land for training, so they want everything removed for their sole mission.
Okay, and then we'll just I'll finish up. So at what point should we expect there not to be any more discussion about safe store versus decon? Is that when does that actually get decided?
I hope that's by 2020, mid-2020.
I mean, we're going to go in with a recommendation. I mean, there can always be issues that might arise to cause some kind of a discussion, but I don't anticipate that. I would say it that way.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. One quick question.
Why? What could arise that would make you switch to SafeStore? Could there be anything that you can think of?
Sure. We don't satisfy the discretionary permit process from the state of California, and so we would be in some sort of safe store until we were able to obtain those permits. So, for instance, Southern California Edison with San Onofre, you know, the plant stopped running in 2012. They elected to not try to repair the plant in 2013, but then they didn't have any permits in hand, right? So now we're looking at their draft. So from 2013 to today, that's the five-year span, right? A half a decade to have that draft environmental impact report, and you can't begin without it as a certified, you know, environmental impact report and a permit in hand. So that's why this concurrence pursuit of the funding and the discretionary permits is so important for this project so that we can begin in 2025.
I would add one thing, too, is that remember, while Tom's right, most of the areas that would cause a challenge are in that area. I mean, one of the main reasons why Humboldt Bay went into safe store is there was no known technology to be able to transfer the fuel from a wet storage to a dry storage. And so every site has a different driver mechanism and may find themselves like Songs did when they were shut down without any time to prepare and not have the permits. They had to go and not do decommission because they weren't approved for it. So they had to go into really a short safe start phase. Every site's different.
So we need to move on to our next presenter. And that's going to talk, and Lauren's going to talk about decommissioning project execution, which hopefully will answer your questions. Lauren Sharp is a PG&E Senior Director for Nuclear Decommissioning. Lauren is responsible for the overall decommissioning of Humboldt Bay Power Plant, which is near completion, and for launching the new Diablo Canyon decommissioning project. Lauren brings decades of experience to bear, ranging from designing, constructing, and operating nuclear power plants, destroying chemical nerve agent weapons, to serving as the Senior Director of Engineering for Diablo Canyon. So, Lauren?
Thanks, Chuck. So to start out a little bit from a direct experience perspective, as we look at all the things that we need to do as we prepare the estimates and do execution, what we did in the Humboldt experience, to give a little bit of perspective there, is we brought in 36 individuals who had experience from a variety of over 24 decommissionings, be they utilities, Department of Defense, Department of Energy sites. And of those 36 people, we spread those through all of the organizations so that as we started to create our estimates, in particular our executions, we had valuable experience as we came up against each of these unique challenges or different processes that we had to evolve as we put together work packages or plans or executions. So that's how we started the process at Humboldt Bay. We also went in and we found those leaders of those sites that had recently completed decommissionings at like the Yankee plants, Main Yankee, Yankee Row, and some of those. And we brought those individuals in and asked them questions about what went well, what didn't go well. And that was part of our overall process of how we made our estimates and how we executed. So in a similar vein, that's really what Eric was talking about today. I mean, we're using some of the same resources to help drive the estimating pieces for this detailed cost estimate, but is also the experience that you've gained as we've done this. Now, in the past 10 years that we've done decommissioning at Humboldt Bay, there's really only been three major decommissionings, one going on at Humboldt Bay, one going on at Zion, similar to the Diablo Canyon facility, and then one in Spain. So there's not been a lot of folks in decommissioning. It's a very small group, and a number of my folks have already gone to decommissioning sites in Fukushima, Zion, Fort Calhoun, a number of them to Songs. And so you'll see as the manpower goes up and down for the different projects, a lot of the staff will move, you know, when they're done with their mission on our site, they'll move to other sites to help other decommissioning sites. So that's kind of how it's we're going to ensure that we have enough detailed experience to not only get the estimates, but also to ensure we have enough background as we do execution. I mean, clearly, decommissioning is not a core expertise of most of an operating utility. You have to supplement it with some site-specific skills from the decommissionings that have gone on in the past. We've also had a lot of decommissioning trips to Zion. There will be others starting. We're going to have Oyster Creek is getting ready to shut down and go on safe store, but we're going to end up with a number of them, like Songs Unit 2, San Onofre Unit 2 and 3, as well as Vermont Yankee getting ready to get on the cusp of getting started. So there will be other activities that occur as we are in this time frame that we can watch and see how the technology emerges or advances to make sure if there's things that we need to consider to be more effective, then that's what we'll look at. Spent fuel pool movement, as soon as we shut down in 24 and 25 with Diablo Canyons 1 and 2, we'll move the fuel from the reactor vessel into the spent fuel pool. Very quickly. As was mentioned earlier, we're looking to match or be able to accommodate a 7-year time frame for storage in the wet storage in the spent fuel pool before we move it to dry cask storage. That will require a number of interactions with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to make sure we get our licenses approved. We have the conditions in our tech specs that would allow us to move at that time frame. Assuming we can accomplish all those technical interactions and licensing discussions, that would then move to the time frame that we would complete moving all the fuel from the wet storage to dry cask storage by the 2032 time frame. During that time frame, as we mentioned earlier, the best thing that we can do for the reducing the cost for Diablo Canyon execution is to make sure that the permitting costs are done, that the designs for like the spent fuel pool island to make sure I can reduce the amount of staff and the amount of equipment I need to operate while I'm in that wet storage time frame. You want to be able to do that as quickly as possible so you're not waiting for a long period of time. Some of what's happened down south in San Onofre because they didn't have this opportunity to go ahead and design spent fuel pool island early, that would give us an advantage. So that's a good thing for us to have this window of opportunity to do the designs, get it implemented shortly after we shut down so that we could then reduce some of our costs and be more effective. Cold and dark is really a safety issue. From a cold and dark, or some sites call it a cool and dim, what you want to do is you want to make sure that you remove the power from essentially everything that you're not going to need so that when I eventually go in and to demolish the plant, whether I'm breaking into a room or a pipe or a concrete, that my workers don't hit an energized circuit. This is all about making sure I know where the power is when I'm doing demolition. So cold and dark is a plan to basically remove the power from the plant and then strategically place the power back on the things that I need during decommissioning. So that's a design effort, much like Spent Fuel Pool Island, where you design how you are repowering the pieces that you need to have power to during decommissioning. You don't want power to the whole plant. That would be a problem. Temporary site infrastructure changes. A good example here is security. I mean, once we have this massive power block and all these things that we used to have to protect while we were in operations, we can go back in and block entrances so I can reduce security posts, so I can reduce less manpower, so I can still protect the things I need to, but I don't need to protect the whole site in the way I used to have to. Another good example, like we have flowing water from the ocean up through the intakes. You don't have to worry about that too much while you're operating because it's full of water. There'll be some increased security posts that will be required in to protect those kind of areas. So there's a plus and a put and a take on security. You want to do as many mods as you can, but you don't want to spend too much time protecting yourself when you're getting ready to demolish the site as well. So we'll be looking at modifications where they're appropriate to do what we need to do. Building demolitions, there will be some buildings that might be in the way, for instance, for security to see decommissioning. We would might just take some of the infrastructure down so it's not in the way either for transport or for security or things that are more impactful to us in a production mode of getting the waste off site. And then we'll move forward as the power block once we get the fuel out of the spent fuel pool and into dry cast storage. We can go more aggressively into facility demolitions because we've removed the power and we can go remove those nuclear systems that might be a concern or hazardous waste like asbestos or PCBs that existed from some of the infrastructure from operating the plant. We go remove those items to make sure we don't have a hazardous mix of waste, and then we'll just knock down the buildings and remove that debris. So that's kind of how you go after building demolitions as time frame moves on year by year. We do own a yard, a rail yard out in Pismo. We are looking at enhancing that rail yard and adding probably 5 rail spurs to that existing site, so we'll have more ability to handle parallel rail shipments for waste. There is a lot of waste in decommissioning. I'll tell you that, and it doesn't matter what sites you're on. There's a lot of waste. And we're a dual unit site. We're going to have a lot of waste. Final status surveys, more to Linda's question. We're required to submit a license termination plan to the NRC no later than 2 years before we shut down and ask for the, or 2 years before we ask for the license, the Part 50 license to be released. Many sites offer that to the NRC earlier than that. Some sites wait. But the license termination plan has a methodology of how you're going to do your final status surveys of the ground. And I will tell you, it's typically in 3 phases. There's like a zone where you knew you had radiological isotopes, and that requires 100% sampling to be able to accommodate the NRC rules and criteria to make sure you've remediated or cleaned it up. The areas that's next adjacent to that where you don't believe you had any risk of radiological, those are typically about a 50% sampling profile. And then those that say that are way outside, like maybe an admin building outside the protected area, those are going to be like a 10% sampling criteria. So that's kind of how the process works. We go through and we show them how many isotopes we're looking at based on each unique site's footprint of what we've had on the site during operations and maintenance. They then agree to whether or not that's the right isotope mix, and then we look at the locations. And so in particular in the discharge case, you know, that would be an area that would most likely be in the 50% sampling criteria, and we would sample out in the actual ocean outside of the discharge. So that's typically how that part is done. And we would then submit those packages to the NRC. They review that. I would also mention that in this particular instance, not only do they review the license termination plan, they actually have a contractor called ORAL out of Oak Ridge, and they will send out teams periodically, take split samples, and do their own sampling on site to make sure that our results are the same as theirs. So both of those typically happen in decommissionings. Site restoration is really once we've completed the nuclear remediation and we are now working towards the site restoration based on any permits we have within the state of California for how we're going to grade that existing contour into more of a natural contour as it is right now. We'll have discussions about, you know, where our mitigation areas are, whether it's upland habitat or marine habitat or whatever they think are the right negotiations. That'll be Tom's area to have discussions about what permit conditions are appropriate. And once the nuclear remediation is complete, then we'll be doing making sure we have no hazardous materials, be it lead or PCBs or asbestos, whatever might exist on the site from long time ago, whether even before we owned the land. We could still have to be doing remediations for that kind of activity. Then we would do that remediation, contour the land, and we would replant with the agreed-to vegetation, which typically has a 5-year monitoring time frame after we've planted the land to make sure that the material we planted is big enough, or we'll plant some more. So from our key takeaways, with the direct experience that we have on the team, the industry benchmarking that we have and will continue to get, and as we watch in the next 7 or 8 years while we operate, you're going to get a lot more insights from how the industry is progressing as we have more and more sites entering decommissioning. And then we'll enhance those schedules or strategies that we have to try and accommodate any of those that might make an improvement in our schedule or cost as we get further in execution. So with the required approval, the key thing for us is we want to be ready with the designs, the permits, and the plans so that on the day we shut down, we have the ability to implement those things that are appropriate to minimize that waiting with a high overhead with making no benefit on decommissioning. We want to be able to move forward as fast as we can.
Great. Thank you, Lauren. Any questions? Yes, Sherry.
Yes, I'm wondering what alternatives you see as possible to trucking and rail transport of waste.
Well, unfortunately, as we've looked at this, my personal opinion is we're probably going to end up with a significant number of trucks going to Pismo and then putting them on the massive rail cars to get out of the state. Many of the waste traffic routes are going to go typically to Clive, Utah, or Arlington, Texas, maybe a few up to Grandview, Idaho. But you wouldn't want to spend trucking routes the whole way. I would say based on the previous engagements that I've had with the regulators, we will evaluate the barging options, but I hold little hope that that's going to be a success path.
Any other questions? Okay, panel, thank you very much, and presenters, thank you very much. We're going to take a break now. It is about 8:31, and we want to have a 10-minute break, so let's come back at 8:42. It'll give us 10 minutes. And please immediately now submit your cards if you would like to speak, and we'll have public comment directly when we come back. Thank you very much. Okay, thank you very much, everyone. Before we begin our public comment period, I would just like to summarize some of the opportunities or pathways that we have for public input. We have the opportunity to speak at public meetings like some of the people today. We have public workshops, public comment meetings, public kiosk in the adjoining room. You can submit comments. You can also submit comments online directly from the community engagement website. And in person to any of the panel members, and they will get those comments to us. So there's numerous opportunities for public input. I'd just like to review the input we've had so far, which is, to me, surprisingly low, but we do anticipate that there's going to be a lot more interest, especially when we get into talking about repurposing and lands. So far, we've had 23 comments through various pathways. And next slide. And you can see here, they pretty much commented on a full range of the topics and issues. Blue bar are the comment forms through the internet or the kiosks. The orange are comments to panel members, and are the red, I mean, and the orange are comments at public meetings so far. So with that, let's proceed to our public comment period. And we have two speakers today. So the first is Lorelei Kappel. Lorelei? Please state your name and your address and any affiliation, please.
Great. My name is Lorelei Kappel. I'm with the Economic Vitality Corporation, 735 Tank Farm Road. Thank you for having me this evening, and thank you all for your time that you're committing to this very important project. We really appreciate you, your community service. I just wanted to introduce myself and let you know that the Economic Vitality Corporation, which is a 501c3 nonprofit, is, you know, here specifically with the last 25 years helping start, grow business on the Central Coast, really to ensure the economic vitality of our region. We are working with community stakeholders in a public-private partnership for the analysis and strategy for the planning for the economic planning of the Diablo Canyon power plant closure. So ultimately, we're just here to let you know that we're here to better understand the economic impacts. We know that you'll be talking about that in your process later this year. I wanted to let you know about our project. You can kind of follow that on our website at slowevc.org. We have a Diablo page that's set up. We've just begun work on June 1st with our consultant team. We'll be taking a look to really better understand the economic impacts on our local communities all the way down to the zip code level and develop a strategy to offset or mitigate those impacts. We're going to be working on this for approximately 2 years and have a very robust public outreach process that will engage residents, business community, local organizations, education, and local government in a number of ways through a series of workshops and one-on-one meetings, small group meetings. But really, the overall goal of our project is to build capacity and really work on a shared ownership strategy for helping our region recover from this. This will be the single largest economic impact that the Central Coast will probably ever see. And this is something that, you know, we're very focused on and really excited to work with the community on. At the end of this project, we will have a strategy that shows us the best ways to mitigate or offset the impacts to our communities, and more importantly, an implementation strategy and a monitoring plan to make sure we're making success towards our goals. So with that, I look forward to talking with you perhaps when you are ready to talk a little bit more about economic development later this year. And in the meantime, feel free to reach out with any questions specific to this topic. And you can find me on our website. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Our next speaker is Jane Swanson. Jane?
Thank you. Yes, Jane Swanson. I am with San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace and a spokesperson. First of all, I want to thank the PG&E presenters and everybody on this advisory panel for being so very well informed. The structure of this meeting is excellent and clear, and the slides that PG&E has shown us have been very, very useful. So thank you for all the hard work that's gone into it. I have two questions. Number one, after all the spent fuel is put into dry casks, I believe the year was 2032, will the spent fuel pool or the cask loading part of it be kept available just in case of a need to repackage one of the dry casks or more than one? I'm thinking that repackaging might possibly be needed in the event of corrosion or leaking of a cask, or hopefully extremely unlikely sabotage of some of the dry storage casks. So that's question number one about the ability to repackage. Question number two is about the trucking of waste products, of waste from the plant. I understand that the thought is most likely scenario is trucking followed by rail. And I'm envisioning both the radioactive waste and the heavy concrete and cut up components of Lord knows what all being removed from the site. And I'm wondering if the, I kind of personally doubt that the roads, the bridges, the overpasses, and the rail beds are qualified to handle such extremely heavy loads. I can't think of anything else that goes on a train through our county and down through Los Angeles that would be nearly as heavy as the stuff that would be coming from a nuclear power plant. So that's my second question. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And that concludes our public comment period for this evening. Again, there are multiple avenues of public input, and we encourage you, if you have any questions or any comments for the panel, to take advantage of those pathways. Now's the time for the panel to have a discussion of anything you've heard or any questions you might want to ask.
I wonder if PG&E would want to respond to the questions that were posed by the lady.
See if I can recall both of your questions, Jane. So for the first question, as I recall, it was associated with waste, you know, the transport of waste over through the process from roads to rail. What I would say is we have been sending the rail cars from Humboldt Bay to Andrews, Texas. We typically load the cars through the process of ensuring that we get the right weight as allowed by the railroads, and we have sent, I'm going to say probably thousands of shipments through the process, through the rail yards, and through that same avenue of rail track is what we're going to use down here. So I don't foresee that overall railroad track bed an issue. Typically, the waste from site are size reduced to make sure they're cut up in small enough pieces that we either make the truck or the trail capacity. So again, I don't think either one of those issues are a problem. There will be, I'm sure, some road maintenance that we'll have to deal with regardless of how we proceed. You had one other question, I was trying to remember.
The spent fuel pool.
Oh, yes, good question. So on the spent fuel pool, once the fuel is moved from wet storage to dry cask storage, we will demolish the spent fuel pool. It is part of our decommissioning requirements, as we must require that we remove all the radiological areas and make sure we clean up the land underneath it. So we will have to take that out. The only related comment that I can respond to in your other question for the ability to reload, that is part of the subject matter currently under review and discussion by the NRC and the proposed rulemaking. And so it's too early for me to say how that might turn out. So I don't know an answer to that one yet.
Thank you. Any other questions? Dina.
Well, it's not a question. It's sort of a comment. I wanted to respond to some information that Tom was delivering. And for those that don't actively work in CEQA or you know, with the Coastal Commission and doing CDP applications, I'm sure, and correct me if I'm wrong, but normally the applicant or whomever is putting the project together is working cooperatively with those agencies throughout the time, shaping, strategizing what the best application is going to look like. So they don't show up one day and just go, ta-da, you know, here's my application. Everybody is aware of what's happening. You manage expectations. And so when that final goes in, most of those agencies are aware and they usually have some idea of how they're going to respond already. And PG&E will also know if there are things that they're asking for that maybe that agency isn't as accepting of, and they'll have to negotiate with them on. So that was just one comment I want to make. Also, I want to thank EBC for being here tonight and also for just being really proactive in this effort, because it is significant. We've been talking about it in a lot of different circles for a while, and so being proactive for our community is I'm very thankful for that.
Lauren.
Would it be possible to put up the agenda items for the rest of the meetings that we have scheduled for the benefit of the folks in the office, in the audience here, so that we could help them plan for when they might particularly want to be in attendance?
We have that. Yes, we do. We'll put it up. There it is. So there's our agenda that you approved at the last panel meeting. In May. So the lands issues deal with in August and September, and you've also discussed the possibility of holding separate workshops and inviting the public to participate and provide presentations and comments during those workshops. October is emergency planning. November, use fuel storage, and December is economic impacts. Any other comments, questions? Alex?
One thing, Chuck, John and I were talking about it briefly. We have this discussion, and, you know, we've the contrast between DECON and Safe Store, and that's a sort of a regulatory category established by NRC. And DECON, you know, is defined as, you know, promptly cleaning up the site, basically to background levels. And Safe Store is, well, waiting for a time period until some radioactive decay occurs or for some other reason, and may extend under the NRC regs to essentially 60 years from the date that the facility stops operating. So that would be 2085. But the important point is that it's not a black and white thing. It's not either 2085 or immediately. They kind of gradate, and it's on a spectrum into each other. And you can have DECON that takes 5, 6, 10, 15 years. You can have Safe Store that starts at year 25 or 30. So it's a spectrum, and even in the DECON, all NRC asks is that the site be cleaned up, quote, promptly, which, you know, means like with all deliberate speed, and it could be, you know, a very short period, or it could be a little bit longer, depending on how the plan is laid out. And NRC will probably go along with pretty much anything that's a reasonable approach on that. So it's not a black and white, you know, this distinction. It's a spectrum.
Great. Thanks for that clarification and sharing that. Kara.
Thank you. Just two quick comments. First, thanks to PG&E. I thought the presentations were really clear and really helpful. So thank you. I learned a lot tonight. And secondly, for those of you who are interested in particular in the land use issues, everything that is related to the topic, we try to keep posted on a Facebook page called Friends of Wild Cherry Canyon. So if you're interested in that issue in particular, just keep checking it. When new information comes up, obviously any hearing dates, we're always posting on that site. It's a good place to get information. But thanks again. Great presentation. Appreciate it.
Any other comments, questions? Well, let's discuss our decommissioning topic for the next meeting in July. Tom?
Thanks, Chuck. So next month, we go further into the funding mechanisms, and that'll look at when funds become available, what is the source, what is their purpose, and how does it affect the overall schedule. And your peer, Mr. Carlin, did put together a primer for you on that about who funds what when. And so some of these things, for instance, repurposing is a good example. It would have a very different funding impact than the traditional rate based decommissioning where customers have funded it and it's just a simple removal. So that will have a good robust discussion on that, but that'll really set us up for the lands discussion the following 2 months. I think we'll have all of the decommissioning fundamentals out of the way to really get into the more meaty topics as well. So that's what we have addressed for next month. And we, depending on agenda time, we can be prepared to set the stage, I think, based on our setting those workshop dates between now and then to really get people ready for August and September as well.
Thank you, Tom. That brings us to the close of our formal agenda. In the interest of continuous improvement for our meetings, I'd like to take a couple of minutes and talk about the things that you liked about this meeting and then opportunities to improve the meetings. So does anybody have any comments about positive aspects? Yes.
This was the most informative session that I've attended. I mean, I learned an awful lot tonight. I really compliment PG&E on the slide presentation, their presentation, each of you that did the presentation. This was really, really good, and I appreciate that.
Thank you. Any other comments? Lauren.
I think it's been helpful how you have rolled out the planning, public notification, getting agenda items out, getting the slides out so that we can review them in advance. Very helpful.
Great. Thank you. Anything else? Opportunity, Linda.
Yeah, I really this helped me understand about, like, no matter what we might want, there are things that we have to do and that you have to do and that you are attending to that. And it gives me, I'm very happy with the way you're doing it. You're trying to get your ducks in a row really well.
Thank you. How about opportunities for improvement? Any suggestions? Okay. Well, thank you. Before we adjourn, I would like to express our appreciation to... I'm sorry. Well, I wanted to thank our stenographers. Carolyn Spree, and the transcript should be available in about 2 to 3 weeks, and it's available on the website. And you can see the actual transcript in addition to the full video of this meeting. And also like to express our appreciation to Julia Townsend and Katie Voice for the hearing interpretation and assistance. So I'll turn it over to John for comments and adjournment.
Yeah, I think that's what Tom's body motion there was to give me an opportunity to also thank the panel and the community. Linda, I appreciate your comment about how important it is to get our ducks in a row. I can't agree with you more. We understand that as a company and as stewards of the resource out there. To that end, we have a truly rare opportunity in San Luis Obispo County and at Diablo site. Most plants, in fact, I'd say all other nuclear plants, did not have this planning horizon that we have. As a consequence of that opportunity, we owe the obligation to do that ducks in the row planning that Linda talks about. And this community engagement is really critical to that. And you think about the timelines that Tom showed us. In order to get to work, you really have to have the submittal of some of the regulatory requirements as much as 5 years ahead of time to just be able to expect to go straight into DCOM. As Alex mentioned, many plants have shut down. And one of them reasons, for example, the reason at San Onofre right now why they're not actively decommissioning the facility is they're in essentially safe store right now because they can't go to work. Their environmental impact report has only now come out. Until that's resolved, there's much of the work is on hold. And as a consequence, stations have not been able to take advantage of the opportunity to go straight into decommissioning as we plan to do, which is our preference. And so this community engagement is very important, particularly over the next few years, so that we'll have the ability to submit the required applications to allow us to go straight into decommissioning, and that's really critical to us. I want to thank the panel and the community to help support our needs to be able to be ready to do that so we can take advantage of this rare opportunity. And with that, thanks again for the panel's time and energy and the community for the input and engagement. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, the panel meeting is adjourned. Thank you all.